This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in 3, our weekly food news roundup. Fall is finally here, so it's time to get funky and devote an episode to some of our favorite spunky microbes.
Fungi just provide this beautiful, whimsical lens on how the world works. They have so many roles. They're this strange and magical-seeming group of organisms, but they've got it all figured out.
Should you eat the cheese rind? Can you eat the rind? These are like the biggest questions.
We'll answer all of your questions about mysterious mushrooms and crazy curds. Plus, we'll give you a sneak listen to the newest season of Modernist Breadcrumbs. So tune in to this week's Meat in 3 on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to HRN Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is Bushwick. I'm Kat Johnson, the Communications Director here at HRN, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Katie Mosman-Wadler.
Hey, Kat.
Hello. And we also have HRN's Program Manager, Hannah Forden.
Happy Thursday!
We just slipped that in.
Hannah has a new title, guys. We're really excited. Hey, congratulations.
It feels official because it's my first happy hour with this title.
Yes. I was just reading the script, and I was like, oh, it's new. I just kept going.
It's awesome. We're really excited.
Yes. And today's guests are Jillian Zettler, Alyssa Mount Smith, and Nisa Hicks from Charleston Wine and Food. We are doing like a very early preview show, but it's never too early to talk about Charleston Wine and Food.
Whoop, whoop.
We'll be heading down once again this spring. The festival is March 6th through 10th, 2019. It's the 14th installment of Charleston Wine and Food, fueled by a contagious passion for the people and places that make Charleston worth celebrating. This year's festival will feature over 100 unique culinary experiences that will fill your belly and feed your soul.
Can't wait.
Welcome, ladies.
Hello, hello.
Thanks for having us.
We're so excited to have you anytime.
It's always a good day to be in Bushwick.
Yes, I agree. So we're going to talk a little bit more about some highlights from last year's festival, what we can expect for next year. But first, we're going to do a few announcements.
So we have a really exciting event coming up this Monday, November 5th, and it is in our very own building, 100 Bogart, which is our amazing co-working space. And it's Co-Ferment, which is a tasting and panel discussion about the intersection of beer, wine, and cider, led by our very own Jordan Werner Berry and cider specialist Daniel Pucci.
The Pooch.
The Pooch, as he's affectionately known. And we're going to focus on the ways in which these seemingly different beverages overlap in terms of production methods, farming, flavor, culture, and the language we use to talk about them. And Jordan has assembled an incredible panel of experts in the field, including John Reynolds of Black Duck Cidery in the Finger Lakes, Derek Trowbridge of Old World Winery in Sonoma, Lauren Grimm, who is based here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, of Grimm Artisanal Ales, and the incredible Krista Scruggs of Zaffa Wines, who's also making some cider in Burlington, Vermont. So it's from 6:30 to 9 on Monday, November 5th. There's going to be lots of opportunities to taste delicious beer, wine, and cider. You can purchase some coffee and maybe some home beer making kits, and we're going to have delicious snacks from Samisa. You can get tickets at Eventbrite, and we hope to see you there.
And if you can't get enough of these funky flavors, you can get a preview of some of our panelists at Raw Wine. That's taking place Sunday the 4th and Monday the 5th of November. We will be partnering with Raw to bring you the Speaker's Corner, which will have a series of panels and interviews and tastings with a lot of the people that will be featured at Raw Wine. It's a fair for organic and biodynamic wines and a few ciders. You can find more info about that at rawwine.com.
And we're really excited that tickets are now on sale for our second annual gala, Winter in the Garden.
Yay!
And last year was an amazing success, and this year it looks like it's going to be even more fun and delicious, and we really hope that many of you can join us. It is on Monday, December 3rd at the beautiful Palm House in Brooklyn Botanic Garden. It's going to be a taste around event again featuring some of our favorite chefs from New York City and also some special guests from outside of the city as well. We're going to have signature cocktails from Damon Bolte and Souther Teague, the host of the Speakeasy, as well as the infamous Dave Arnold. We're going to have music from DJ Cherish the Love and lots of amazing auction lots and games. You'll be able to hang out and mingle with your favorite HRN hosts and personalities. And it's going to be, I think, the best holiday party of the season. I'm going to go ahead and say that. So you can also get tickets for that at Eventbrite or check out our Facebook or website. And yeah, it's going to be on December 3rd. See you
Mark
there.
Mark your calendars. Cool. All right. Well, those are our announcements for the week. And now we're going to turn back to our friends from Charleston Wine and Food. So let's kick it off. This is kind of the first time we've publicly debriefed about how awesome this festival was this past year. What were some of your favorite moments, Jillian, like your highlights of the festival?
Oh, I get to step in my time capsule. It feels so far away now. You know, I don't know. I think that our Queens on King that we did, that our drag brunch the first year of that, was just completely epic. It was honestly like one of the most joyful events. I've said that over and over again, and I've been doing kind of food festival events for almost a decade, and there was just this sense of unity and happiness, and the food was phenomenal, and it was just the perfect cap to the whole weekend. So that was a standout.
Were you kind of, that was the first time you'd done a drag brunch. Mm-hmm. Were you kind of nervous about what people's reactions would be to that, or did you have a sense that like Charleston's gonna love this?
I think that like deep down in our bellies, it's just that there's a feeling in Charleston that I feel like we wanted to push that energy out farther. You know, like I think that there were some people that were asking that very question, but our gut reaction as a team internally was like, no, people are going to want to throw down at this thing and it's going to be fun. And then whatever we thought, it was just like 15 steps beyond that of people having a great time. And the demographic was so, so interesting at that event.
How so?
Just young people, old people, people that have been like tried and true fans of the festival since the beginning, that are in their like late 60s and love the gospel brunch, but were just wearing feather boas and glitter tiaras. And it was amazing. It was a really, really, really cool thing.
So we talked a little bit sort of offline about plans for the next year. And you guys talk a lot about how you keep some things, but you really want to change it up every year. You want the festival to be fresh and interesting. But you are going to bring back the drag brunch.
We are, and we're moving it to a new space. So Lowndes Grove is a beautiful plantation. It's really one of the only plantations on the peninsula. It's got stunning views right on the water. So again, it's like kind of this juxtaposition of something that feels very progressive in a really historical place. And it should be just as epic, I think.
So we should 100% pack our boas and glitter.
And 5-inch heels and whatever else you can get in that suitcase. Absolutely.
Consider it done.
Good.
So how do you decide what events you do keep? What makes the cut? And then how do you kind of take into consideration what was a big success and brainstorm what to do new next year?
It's interesting. I would say it's a pretty democratic process internally. Like we do a lot of big powwows and we have a big retreat after the festival's over. And sometimes it's like, okay, people love that so much. It still feels new. We should absolutely, like, maybe there are natural ways that we feel like we could enhance it or make it slightly different with a new interpretation. And sometimes it's like, okay, people really love this, but are we as in love with planning a new installment of it? And I think when we don't feel inspired in a way to be able to put a new twist on it, we feel like we need to pack it away. And then that doesn't mean, like, there really are no rules with the way that these things go. So it doesn't mean that 2 years or 5 years from now, an event that you loved might actually make a sneak appearance back into the lineup.
So for 2019, what are going to be some of the bigger changes or bigger themes, initiatives that you guys are going to be bringing on?
Well, I mean, dating back to us kind of doing a regroup together with HRN after the festival closed last year, you know, we had talked about how International Women's Day is falling on the Friday of the festival for 2019. And then that we really, really wanted to not only increase the lack of, there tended to be many more women at the men at the festival than women, and trying to make a concerted effort to change that, and putting steps in motion to really see that come to life through the attendees. So not only did we take some fantastic advice on connecting with, you know, using the EAT database, and putting out a specific letter to local chefs in Charleston to try to draw more female participants, we were really successful in doing that. So I would say celebrating women and not just making it a one-time thing, but that this is really going to be the launching pad to have more gender and ethnic diversity in the festival's lineup.
That's awesome. And you're going to do some special programming on that Friday as well?
Yeah. I think one of the events I'm excited about on that day is called Smoking in the Boys Room. So typically, the festival has kind of ended with like a very like pit master heavy, barbecue heavy event to cap off the weekend, which kind of seems counterintuitive to feeling really full at the end of the weekend. But we're doing that event on Friday this year, and there's a whole host of just really killer female pit masters. Ooh. That will be involved in that event. And it happens to be taking place in this property called The Bend, which is owned by this woman, Susan Perlstein, who's just one of the most amazing female businesswomen in South Carolina. So it's just, it's kind of a convergence of a lot of really great things.
Great. How have you seen like the relationship between Charleston Wine and Food and the overall Charleston food scene shift or change over the past 14 years?
Well, I can certainly speak for the last five, because that's when I've been in there, and then certainly as like a visitor to the city prior to that. But I do remember having a conversation when I first landed in Charleston. People were like, well, what do you see coming down the line? And you started to see this like peppering of more neighborhoods being established, the same way like when you know go to Manhattan or even here in Brooklyn. I'm sure it feels like each little pocket kind of is starting to create its own identity. And I think in the last 5 years, and certainly in the last 14, you see that in Charleston, that there's just different food identities all the way around the peninsula. And then even that the food is really far extended beyond just beyond downtown Charleston into, you know, James Island, John's Island, Mount Pleasant, Sullivan's Island, North Charleston, having an amazing food scene. So, you know, just kind of the breadth of everything there has been a really, really large amount of growth, I think, in the past 5 years.
So we've done more and more food festivals, and especially festivals and events, and well, we're in New York too. So any event we do here is very specific to a certain neighborhood. And then you go to food festivals in other cities. And I always say it's so different from Charleston because everything's so much more spread out. And that's one of the strengths, I think, of the peninsula. Everything is so easy to get to.
Yep.
So as Charleston's growing and as you have all these different new pockets that are a little bit more outside of the beaten path, how do you try to incorporate those new areas and those new restaurants and food scenes while keeping like the ethos of the festival kind of based around downtown?
Well, I mean, I think that you guys as generators of content, for us, it's kind of following the stories, you know, and we want to, through the events that we produce, be really great storytellers. So I think it really just kind of comes to what is inspiring us at the moment, and then really making that the foundation of the programming from year to year. And I think for locals, what we're excited about is that sometimes we're uncovering places and spaces, people, stories that it's in their own backyard and they don't even know that it's there. So I think it feels like less of a hindrance and more of really like kind of an exciting thing to go, oh my gosh, that's 3 miles from my house and I never knew that they were, you know, growing lettuce vertically in, you know, shipping containers. That's amazing. There's monks growing these amazing mushrooms up in the hills, you know, 5 miles from where I live. So I think that people generally are just kind of excited about dipping out beyond King Street.
And I know you guys are doing a couple of events throughout the year, like small events here or there to kind of keep buzz going. Can you talk a little bit about how you come up with activations or pop-ups throughout the year to keep people interested?
I mean, there's certainly a lot of ideas that come internally, but I have to give credit to the fact that we've got an amazingly vibrant chef community. And I think, like, the thing, one of the things that inspired me to want to take the job in Charleston as the executive director is that so many people take such sincere ownership. Like, you could ask 30 different people, like, who founded Charleston Wine and Food. And there's so many people, I was a part of that. And it was part of that wanting the ownership to make it great that makes it really exciting. So ideas are generated from the relationships we have with chefs. Sometimes it's a fantastic partner of the festival. You know, as we're recapping, we're trying to encourage people to throw ideas our way. And then it's just being open and flexible enough to know that an idea could start, you know, somewhere and end up somewhere completely different by the time tickets go on sale. And then being okay to kind of ride along with that, not get boxed into like what you might have put on paper back in April.
Mm-hmm. And tickets have gone on sale.
They have gone on sale.
For all events?
All events, including the things that we're producing out of our own test kitchen this year.
Cool. And how did you have a bunch of events sell out, or do people have still a good opportunity to get out there and buy tickets to a lot of events?
There's still a great diversity of tickets that are available. We definitely sell a ton of tickets within the first couple of weeks, but it's not like the leftovers are leftovers. I mean, there's fantastic programming that people can take advantage of, certainly.
And for people who aren't super familiar with Charleston Wine and Food and the format, because there are so many different types of tickets on sale, can you talk a little bit about the structure and how there are dinners and different types of events?
Yeah. So unlike, you know, some festivals sell like a kind of a one-stop shop pass, right? Where you can kind of, you have to buy one ticket and then you've bought everything and then you decide what you're going to do. We kind of come from a place where we want the experience to be completely a la carte. And, you know, everybody's going and participating for the festival for different reasons. And we really think that's one of the strengths in the way that it's designed, is that you can decide to go, you know, to a signature event that might be 150-500 people. It's late night, it's more lively. You can do something super cerebral and, you know, go to a beverage workshop and really dive deep on a certain varietal of wine. You could take a cooking class with only 40 people up front and close with a chef. You know, the Culinary Village, where you guys are usually camped out and recording interviews, is probably the most fluid space, but there really is something for everybody. And we try to vary the price point. You know, we know that some things, even kind of financially, might be loss leaders, but the content's really important to us and producing the experience is really important to us. So we try to make sure we've got a really, really great variety.
Can you talk about like who's at the festival and how, I mean, because I think what's amazing is how many people come to Charleston to show up for this festival.
Yeah. I mean, from a talent standpoint, I mean, we had over 400 chefs participate last year and over 150 beverage professionals, certainly around those numbers again this year. We had just under 30,000 people that came as attendees to the festival last year, and it was about a 50-50 split of locals and tourists. And, you know, I'm always surprised in a beautiful way every year, just how people mark that first full week in March. And that's where they're planning on being because of this event. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of weight that you carry, and that's kind of what charges you forward to make sure the programming is always really inspiring, because, you know, it's such an important part of people's year to come and connect and celebrate.
So since we're kind of in the part of the year that's not super Charleston Wine and Food focused, you know, where we gear up more at the beginning of the year, I am super curious to all of you, where are the places that you like to go, what I'm calling off season? Like, what are your regular spots in Charleston?
Oh, I know what they would say is my regular. I love Hurry Ollie. It happens to be right in our hood. It's a beautiful little tiny restaurant that's definitely like whole food generated, a lot of like vegan, vegetarian, beautiful dishes. I mean, these killer nachos with this cashew nacho cheese that I think that we would all like completely cover in everything. They're so yummy and they make an excellent matcha latte. What else are our stomping grounds? I love Indaco. It's so good. Their house-made burrata is just insane.
Leon's is close to our office, and if you want the Siam salad, that thing is amazing.
I love Camp High makes killer sushi. It's in a little strip mall in Mount Pleasant, but it's beautifully fresh. That's one of my favorite spots. You're getting me in trouble here. I'm not supposed to play favorites.
Graft Wine Shop is like my go-to stop on the way home for my stocking up of bottles and, at my
and
house.
Goat Sheep Cow, the ladies there are amazing, and they have this thing that they call crack cheese that, like, with a baguette and some of that crack cheese, like, it can fix any problem that you have.
Is it like a pimento cheese?
It's kind of like a creamy, and they're gonna yell at me because I'm gonna get it's like a feta-y sort of scenario.
Goat cheese,
kind of very creamy, and it just like slides right across a fresh baguette. Yum. It's beautiful.
That's awesome. Someone on Facebook was asking, like, I'm going to Charleston. What are the places that have been open in the past 6 months that I should go? And Graft was what came to mind for me because I'm like, I don't really know timelines, but I do know that Graft is less than 6 months because he was opening the same weekend of Charleston Wine and Food this past year.
Melfi's just opened. Chubby Fish is new. Josephine Wine Bar, great wine program there and beautiful food. I mean, there's a lot.
Costa's amazing at Josephine.
Yeah, there's a lot of new.
Is that any relation to Josephine Nashville?
No. Different. No, different. Yep. Baba's on King just opened. Yeah, there's so many new things. Wait till you guys.
Does it seem like there are more things opening at a faster rate right now?
It's hard to say. It doesn't seem necessarily feel like a faster rate, but you know, I think just like every place, it's this like constant balance of staffing and workforce and all of that. So I think everybody is kind of, you know, juggling that as something to contend with.
So in the planning process of the festival right now, kind of where are you? What are the big things that you're currently working on for next year?
So this is when things start to shift left, less into like who's doing what and more into how they're doing those things. So we've like kind of tipped into the logistical planning phase and, you know, how people are going to activate and what partners are going to be doing on the ground and what things are truly going to look like. And that's kind of a fun thing. It's nice that the year is really balanced into like designing the programming and figuring out who's going to be in each event and then how it all comes together. And that to me, it always feels really miraculous that everything is conversations and emails and spreadsheets and all of that. And then it becomes this like living, breathing thing for 5 days.
And now is the time when it starts to feel like the living, breathing thing?
I don't think it really feels that way to me until the tents start going up in Marion Square. Like, that's when you're like, okay, it's here. Or when the when the packages start, like, coming in and we're going, okay, we've got magazines and Le Creuset and all, you know, Williams-Sonoma is, you know, sending things. And that's when the shipments start coming, it starts feeling really real.
Things are happening.
Yeah.
You're kind of the core team. There's three of you. I know that there are more that work on Charleston Wine and Food, but then how big does the team kind of swell leading up to the actual festival?
So there's, at this point now, we're at 10. We have 10 full-time staff members.
Wow.
And that swells, I would say, to like kind of a core between full-time and contract, about 30 to 35 people. And then with all of the folks that amplify that during the weekend of, I mean, there's probably 80, I would say, that are doing all of the behind the scenes. And then we've got over 500 volunteers that we could not do the event without. And shout out to Jenna Kepley, who is managing all of those 500 volunteers, because that's a big job.
How do people get involved in being a volunteer for the festival?
You can head to our website and you can sign up. And I think that's actually, you know, a great way to kind of understand the festival. We've actually had a lot of people who have just moved to Charleston and they're like, oh, that event like sounds really interesting. Maybe I'll volunteer. Our operations manager actually started as a volunteer for the festival. We pulled her in as the volunteer coordinator and now she's our ops manager. So
nice.
You never know what can happen when you volunteer.
Cool. Well, let's take a really quick break and we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more Charleston Wine and Food, and then we'll play a little bit of trivia that Hannah wrote for you guys.
It's weird.
Oh, the trivia.
Always.
We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
Welcome back to HR and Happy Hour. We're here with the ladies, the fabulous ladies of Charleston Wine and Food. Okay, so we've talked a lot about Charleston, but you guys are very lucky in that you get to come hang out in New York a few times a year, which is nice because we love to hang out with you. So I'm going to flip kind of the question about Charleston, your go-tos. What do you love to do while you're in New York?
Eat.
I would never guess.
Lots of eating. I'm like a soul cycle evangelist. So usually it's eating and then it's spinning to try to like negate all the Roberta's pizza and everything that we're trying to cram it all in while we're here.
Do you have Soul Cycle in Charleston?
No, we've got a great local studio called Charleston Revolution that I'm addicted to. So we'll get you on a bike. You can come and eat. Well, no. Hannah's making big eyes at me.
Bike. Scared.
I think it's the walking. Like, I love that you can walk everywhere and everything is connected and the city just always kind of fuels you with a lot of good energy.
I think that's why a lot of New Yorkers like to go to Charleston Wine and Food, though, because you still get to walk around a lot. You don't feel like, oh, I just spent a week in a city eating. You're like, no, I still at least maintained my walking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Any other like restaurants you have your eye on? I know you said you went to Cosme last night.
It was awesome. I thought it was so great that the food was just elevated and beautiful, but not stuffy. I mean, you can just even like all the way down to the precision lighting over the tables. Mm-hmm. It was just great. And the soundtrack, like whoever is in charge of curating their playlist, it was just really cool of celebrating, the heritage of the food. And then also like really modern, great playlist was on point.
Tonight we're going to carve out after our soul cycle at Pig and Cow for the coconut rice with Leah Cohen.
Yeah. Oh, that coconut rice. That's my jam.
And Leah was at the festival last year, mm-hmm. right? Is she returning?
Yeah.
She's coming this year, and she's doing a really cool event we're excited about called Kameon Night. This was her brainchild, so it's exciting to see her kind of bring this to life in Charleston. It's going to be a traditional Filipino feast paired with Orchid, who's one of our South Carolina State chef ambassadors. And it's going to be really fun. You can still get tickets to that one, too. So that's one of the, like, hidden gems, I think, that's on the website for people to go check out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. All right. Well, let's jump into a little bit of trivia.
Let's do it.
Hannah, do you want to read or do you want me to read?
I would love to.
I always get an F at this. Be easy on me, Hannah.
I get to play either. This time. This
you know, is fun. I was, oh, good. I don't know. Yeah, I was like, it was early on Monday morning, and I just went down a strange path. So
we're ready.
As you probably know, Charleston is named in honor of British King Charles II, who reigned from 1660 to 1685. And so King Charles II is the subject of today's trivia.
Oh, God. I'm looking at you, Alyssa.
Not the kind of Charleston history you maybe thought.
Taking you by surprise. Okay. So Charles II was one of the most popular and beloved monarchs in British history and was known to love a party. So which of the following nicknames did his subjects give their king? Is it 1, Old Coppernose, 2, The Merry Monarch, 3, The Lion, or 4, The Red King? So all of those are real king nicknames, but only one of them belongs to Charles II. So it's Old Coppernose, The Merry Monarch, The Lion, or The Red King?
I kind of want to go with... Where are you going?
I was thinking 2. It just sounds the most...
The Merry Monarch?
Yeah.
I want to go with the copper just because it sounds the weirdest and that should be what it is.
It sounds like someone missing their nose.
Old copper nose.
Okay, you're going with Copper Nose?
I'm going with Copper Nose.
Okay, well, the answer is the Merry Monarch.
Oh, man. Oh. That was too what my obvious. Gut said. Sorry.
It's too obvious.
Okay. So, I'm going to jog your English history muscles a little bit. So, Charles came of age during what war fought on English soil?
Oh, gosh. I don't know anything about wars on English soil.
What about you two?
Okay, I'll give you a hint. There were no other countries involved.
The War of England.
Okay, it's the English Civil War. I'll give you...
Oh, the War of England. I think it was pretty close. If you ask the peanut gallery, I'd give it to you.
The English
yeah,
War.
Yeah, I'll give it to you. I'll give it to you.
That English one.
Okay, so this is a fun one. In 1649, Charles II's father, Charles I, was executed by what method?
How fun.
I know, right?
He was beheaded.
Yes!
Yeah. Guillotine.
Okay.
So French of them.
Another super fun one. Early in Charles's reign, his capital city was struck by the Great Plague of London. What illness was the Great Plague?
Cholera.
Bubonic.
Black Plague? Bubonic.
Bubonic.
The bubonic plague.
Okay, last one. King Charles and his wife, Catherine of Braganza, never had any children, but it's well known that he had children out of wedlock with many other women. How many children is it estimated that King Charles II had?
Oh, gross. Gross is right. 13?
I'll give it to you. It was 12. That's
very close.
Yes. Baker's dozen.
Oh, Baker's dozen. Don't ruin that for me, Hannah.
That was fun trivia.
Yeah, well done.
Thanks for the uplifting trivia.
Bubonic plague, beheading, and extramarital affairs on HRN.
I knew if it was about Charleston, you guys would kick it out of the park. So I had to make it kind of sneaky to keep you on your toes.
Good stuff.
I want to know who the copper nose, old copper nose is.
That was Henry VIII.
Did he have a fake nose?
So it's got to be alcohol, right?
Yeah, I think it was from drinking. He also had a lot of, like, weird health problems. So
he had a fake...
People were not healthy back then.
No, they were not.
Yeah, lots of venereal diseases and no fun.
It's lunchtime.
So fun.
Are you guys... You want some pizza?
Time for pizza. All right. Well, to end things, one more time, how can people find out about Charleston Wine and Food Festival and learn more and get tickets and all that good stuff?
The best way is to head to our website, follow us on Instagram, and find us on Facebook and Twitter. But the website is the best place to get a resource, as a resource, charlestonwineandfood.com.
Amazing. All right. Well, that is our show. Thanks again to Jillian, Alyssa, and Nisa for joining us today. And thanks to Hannah and Katie and our engineer, Matt Patterson.
Yay, Matt.
Yay, Matt. Oh, I thought I was going to say something, like, and he's not. Speak. Okay.
Oh, no.
He's like, I was yes? Like,
I was thinking about hitting the applause, but then I was like, am I really going to do that for myself?
Oh, you're
I
so mean, humble.
Why not?
We'll clap for you.
You have the power.
I know, but I don't want to abuse it.
That's really so thoughtful. Good. Okay.
Also, I was so ready for breaking news, and then you didn't do it, and I was like,
oh. Oh, yeah. Whoa. No breaking news today. Slow news day in at HRN. Yep. All right. Well, that is our show. Thanks for listening. I'm Kat Johnson, and we'll see you next week.
HRN Happy Hour is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.